to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Since the 1930s, the Columbia River has been tamed and reshaped by an array of dams that stretch from the Bonneville Dam east of Portland to the Grand Coulee Dam near the Canadian border. Not only have these dams destroyed abundant salmon runs, they have also inundated innumerable sacred indigenous sites. Now a new assault is being planned on the river, a pumped storage project near the town of Goldendale. While being touted as a critical source of green energy, the project faces fierce opposition from the tribes and most environmental groups in the region. Today we talk with Elaine Harvey, a member of the Rock Creek Band, who works for Yakima Nation Fisheries, and Simone Anter, staff attorney with Columbia Riverkeeper, about why they believe this pumped storage hydroelectric development threatens irreplaceable tribal cultural resources, fish, and wildlife. Elaine and Simone, welcome to Locus Focus.
Hi, Barbara. Thanks for having us.
Well, we're going to talk today about a method of storing energy that I think most people are not that familiar with, and it's called pumped storage, and it's becoming a big issue here in the Northwest. So before we get into the specific project in Goldendale that's being proposed, I wanted to have one of you describe what pumped storage is.
Pumped storage generally is a hydropower, and it's a type of hydroelectric energy storage. So it's a configuration of two large water reservoirs at different elevations that generate power as water moves down through a turbine, and then this draws power as it pumps water to the upper reservoir. So in the case of the Goldendale pump storage development, what we're seeing is Rye Development wanting to build the largest pump storage development in the Pacific Northwest, and this would be along the Columbia River's banks in Klickitat County, Washington, right near the John Day Dam, if listeners are familiar with that area. As part of the proposal, the developer wants to build an off-stream pump storage complex, which would include the upper and lower reservoir, an underground water conveyance tunnel, underground powerhouse, 115 and 500 kilovolt transmission lines, a substation switchyard, and other facilities that are associated with it. And then just a little more generally about pump storage. So pump storage generates hydroelectricity for peak periods of demand. So when electricity on the grid is abundant, the developer would pump water from the lower reservoir into the higher one. And then when there's a demand for this electricity, the water would be released in the upper reservoir through the turbines back into the lower reservoir.
I first heard about pump storage actually from Richard Heinberg in a book he wrote about our renewable future a few years ago. And his contention was that we don't have adequate storage to store energy for the times when renewables aren't able to produce energy. And therefore, he was looking at other options, and one was pump storage. It sounded like it was not the most direct way to be able to store energy, and it seemed really kind of complicated and very technical. And I'm wondering if you all have concerns about the real feasibility of pump storage, if it's really a great answer to our renewable future.
So one question that some of the Yakima Nation staff have on this particular project is the purpose of the project. They're claiming is we need these water pump storages to store power from, you know, for wind and solar, and, you know, for green energy and climate change to address some of those issues. But one of the questions that were brought up was how much carbon is it going to take to build this multi-billion dollar project in this location? And there are multiple water pump storages projects proposed going on in the Columbia Basin currently. So one question was, you know, you're claiming this is green energy, it's going to help climate change, but really how much carbon is it going to take to construct this particular project? And similar water pump storages in the basin.
It sort of reminds me of some of the arguments that are being made in favor of the small nuclear module reactors that are being proposed as a green energy, as carbon neutral energy. In that it seems like, again, it's a really complicated and expensive technology, and it's also going to take a long time to get them up and running. I'm wondering if you see any kinds of parallels between the arguments being used for promoting so-called small modular nuclear reactors and the pump storage facilities.
I think that one thing you can definitely say is that this is really speculative energy development we're dealing with. As you mentioned, pump storage developments, they're incredibly costly. This one's proposed to cost $2 billion, and that's before construction has started. So we always know that construction prices go up as they're being built. They take an extremely long time to build, and I think even more importantly, they've consistently, you know, met opposition from tribal nations. And I think bottom line is this is not really where we should be focusing our green energy development. We've seen other projects, wind and solar energy, that's happened on you know, different tribal nations ceded land that have not met such, you know, fundamental opposition as this project has. And I think in general, it's also just from Riverkeeper's perspective, really important that we mention that, you know, as an organization, we're not opposed to pump storage generally, nor true green energy projects. However, when tribes have consistently voiced that this site is inappropriate and that this pump storage development will, you know, irreparably harm and destroy tribal cultural resources, it's really imperative that we listen to this. And I think this is the third pump storage project proposal at this site that has, you know, been met with tribal opposition. So it's not a surprise that it's a problematic spot. And so the fact that these proposals are, you know, quite zombie-like and keep, you know, coming up from the dead over and over is really problematic.
Well, Elaine, I want to talk a little bit about this site and then go back into history and just talk about this whole history of the development of the Columbia River for energy, for industry, and the impact that that's been having on all the tribal people that live along the Columbia River. But first of all, let's talk about the site itself. Where is the site and what is your relationship to the site?
So the site, as Simone mentioned, is located right at the John Day Dam. And so they want to create a reservoir in the bottom near the dam and one reservoir on top. I'm from the Klamath Bluh Band, which is one of the 14 tribes and bands that comprise the Yakima Nation. And our band is from a watershed called Rock Creek, and our traditional name is Kamitpa, and it's just located, you know, less than 10 miles from the proposed water pump storage site. And this location on top of the ridge where they want to put the top reservoir is right at our sacred site, our sacred mountain, to the Kamitpa band and to other bands on the Columbia River. It's a well-known sacred site. It's a site where we gather our foods, historically, and medicines. We hunted there. And even at the bottom site where they want to build the lower reservoir is a food gathering area where we've been going, you know, since time immemorial. And then not far from the lower reservoir, which is near the Columbia River, is where we still fish for salmon. I'm actually from the Kamitpa Band, and I'm from the Willow White's Pump Band, which were historically located at the Columbia River site where I said they fished. We had a village there. When the Columbia River dams were built, my families from both villages were removed from their prehistorical village sites because they said, the Army Corps said, you guys are going to get flooded out because of the John Day Dam and the Dalles Dam. So my ancestors were all removed from both locations. So this particular site has a name, and the tribal name for this location is called Putalish.
I'm thinking as you're talking about this newsreel that I watched a number of years ago that was about the opening of the Dalles Dam, and it showed Indian fishermen fishing from the scaffoldings by Celilo Falls, and the voiceover was a disappearing fish for a disappearing people. And it seemed to be the attitude in 1957 when that dam opened that the Indians didn't matter. It didn't matter who the people that had lived on these lands for so many thousands of years, that they were just in the way of progress. And I wonder if you feel that this attitude is still perpetuated today in spite of all the much more awareness now amongst the general public about the damage that all these dams have done to fish runs and to the cultural resources of all the tribes.
I think about that a lot because I'm kind of in the forefront. You know, I think about the loss of many tribal villages and many tribal fishing sites like Salila, which was the most significant fishing site to all the Columbia River tribes and bands. And, you know, I just think about the desecration of many of our cultural sites. My great-grandmother was buried near the Columbia, near Roosevelt. And when they built John Day Dam, that cemetery was inundated, and they could not find my grandmother's and many of the relatives' bodies. And so that was totally lost under the river. And there are many of those cemeteries of our people that were inundated, as well as our cultural resources, our petroglyphs, and areas that we gather food. You know, those are all lost and inundated underneath the waters of the Columbia. And, you know, I think about that time that our people had to, you know, had to deal with that desecration and deal with the loss of fishing sites and villages. My grandmothers were left homeless. When the Army Corps took their property, they were left homeless. And many of these village sites along the river, there were village sites, and today they're Army Corps parks, they're county parks, and they're state parks. And people don't realize, oh yeah, let's go to the park. Well, that was a village site, and the people that lived there were removed, and they were left homeless with no compensation, and those were my grandmothers. So that's just some of the impacts that these dams had. They left a lot of families homeless. And it's not fair, because you think about the community near the Bonneville Dam. The whole town was relocated and they all got new homes and they were compensated, but the tribal villages were not. You know, not just one thing, you're losing your home, then you're losing your fishing sites at the same time, you're losing the Celilo Falls, which is, you know, the biggest native fishery in the Columbia. You know, you just lose all that. And then for many years, I mean, first you had the Bonneville Dam, the Dalles Dam, John Day Dam, and then McNary Dam, and you kind of go up the river. There's tribal villages all the way up to the Wanapum Village, and then the Colville Lands and the Spokane Tribes, you know. So we're all impacted by all the dams for energy and irrigation and transportation. So, you know, we had to give up a lot. We didn't just give it up. It was taking away our rights, our homes, and our livelihoods.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KRU Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFGLPFM and KODXLPFM, KMUN and KCPB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Elaine Harvey, who's a member of the Rock Creek Band who works with the Yakima Nation Fisheries, and Simone Anter with Columbia Riverkeeper about why a proposed pump storage hydroelectric development threatens irreplaceable tribal cultural resources, fish, and wildlife. Elaine, do you feel that anything has changed since those days in terms of this project now? Do you feel like you're being listened to any more than you were? And actually, I guess I'll back up a little bit. I don't know how unified the tribes were in opposing the dams back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. But it seems like there's been a lot of opposition to subsequent projects, whether it's green energy or whether it's very non-green energy. Is that an accurate observation that the tribes are more organized now? And then the second part of the question is if you feel like this time you may be listened to.
I feel the tribes are organized more. I'm also a Columbia River Intertribal Fisheries Commissioner. Recently I was appointed as a commissioner, and it's also known as CRITFIC, and they're located in Portland, Oregon. But it's an organization of the four tribes, Yakima, Warm Springs, Umatilla, and Nez Perce. So with that organization, you know, it gives us an opportunity to deal with a lot of the fisheries management issues on the Columbia and tributaries. So it gives us a more unified voice when it comes to the dams on the Columbia also and dealing with fish passage issues. So I think the tribes are more organized, but it's the fact of getting the local politicians and the state and, you know, all the way up to the federal politicians to listen to us. So individually, the tribes, you know, we deal with our states because we're located in Washington. So, you know, we deal with the Washington state government. But to some point, we are heard, and then to some point, we're not heard. And, you know, and it's hard when we're not heard. We've been dealing with Klickitat County commissioners for, you know, for many, many, many years, trying to get our point across to them that the Klickitat County is within the Yakima Nation ceded lands, and the ceded lands gives us rights to fish, hunt, and gather, and it gives us, it, you know, we retained our rights through the 1855 treaty, and so getting the Klickitat County commissioners and the government, local county government, you know, trying to explain to them, it's like ongoing, that we retain our rights and this water pump storage is located on the Yakima Nation ceded lands. And, you know, it's directly impacting our right to access. If this project does go forward, you know, it's going to impact the resources there. It's going to impact the plant resources that we utilize. It could impact the hydrology of the area and the wildlife, and especially all the cultural resources and the sacred mountain site, you know, and all this is within the Yakima Nation ceded lands. And one important point is the Rock Creek Kamithpa chief was a chief treaty signator at the 1855 treaty that the Yakimas had with the U.S. government. So our chief from Rock Creek, you know, he was there. And when I think about our treaty signatories, I always think about, they didn't just think about, you know, that day that the treaty was signed. They thought about many generations down the road. And, you know, that's kind of where I always go back to and think about is, you know, they signed that treaty, and they also wanted to ensure that the future generations were going to retain that right to fish, hunt, and access all these resources, you know, in the ceded land. And if you think about Yakima Nation ceded land, it's actually 1/3 of Washington state, and it extends into Oregon and Columbia River. So, you know, we have a big, extensive area that we have those reserve rights in. And this water pump storage is, you know, in that area, and it's a sacred mountain.
Well, Simone, I understand that the Washington Department of Ecology has a say in whether this project goes forward, and I'm wondering if you have a sense of what their position is, first of all, on pumped energy storage in general, and the position on this specific project.
At this point, at the state level, the Washington Department of Ecology has initiated the state environmental review process for this development. So ecology at this point has determined that the project may lead to significant adverse impacts on the environment. And so they are requiring an environmental impact statement. Currently, they're also in the process of reviewing the applicant's 401 water quality certification application and is set to make a decision on that application on June 29th. And so at that point, we'll kind of get a better sense of ecology's position on this project. There's a few ways it could go with the 401 certification. They could deny the water quality certification. They could deny without prejudice so that the applicant can reapply after the environmental impact statement has been conducted, or they could grant the 401 certification. But without that certification, the project cannot move forward. In terms of pump storage, generally, I'm not quite sure if ecology has taken a position. In terms of this project, we know that there is not a specific statement. The Governor Inslee has not taken a statement. And in fact, you know, we are pushing and, you know, sending letters to the governor's office and letting them know about tribal opposition to this project, environmental groups' opposition to this project, and you know, really letting folks know that there is opposition. I think just generally the project proponents here, Rye Development and Copenhagen Infrastructure Partners, have done a really excellent job of muddling the public opinion on specifically the tribe's position on this project and, you know, opposition to this project, making it seem that folks are on board, that there's really great consultation with the tribes. Any of their application materials that you read or interviews that you listen to, it sounds like they're working so closely with Yakama Nation and it's all going great, which clearly if we've been listening to anything Elaine's saying, that's not the case. So, but that's kind of where it stands at the state level. There's also a concurrent federal licensing process going on through FERC right now as well.
Well, I've got the sense that this Washington state is doing a lot right now and moving ahead towards having total renewable energy in their portfolio in the very near future. And I'm wondering how pumped energy storage fits into that. I got a sense from some of the stuff that I read that there are voices within Washington state government that think that pumped energy is really a great way to have a totally renewable future.
I think that it's really important to point out that so far in Washington state, there's no decarbonization analysis that's pointing specifically to this facility as necessary to meet the state's decarbonization goals, which I think is, you know, really important at this point. I think right now there's a huge push for renewables, for green energy storage, and that's why it's really, really important and like a really great opportunity for us to not just to keep pushing that we can't just fast track green energy developments in the name of a climate solution and end up putting the burdens on tribal nations and on people of color who are already, you know, on the front lines of climate change. They can't also be on the front lines of green energy development. And I think we're in a really great opportunity right now to take a really close, in-depth look at where energy development in the Pacific Northwest is going to go and how just that green energy development is or is not going to be.
Well, I remember a number of years ago, there was plans to put a giant wind farm on the Columbia Hills, and it was fought by the Columbia Gorge Audubon Society, and I think probably the Portland Audubon got involved in that too. And it was stopped. And this is at the time when there was a lot of wind development happening in Washington State on the hills, and then a little bit later in Oregon. But the reason for opposing the one in the Columbia Hills had to do partly with it was right at the edge of the National Scenic Area, and also that it was right in the Pacific Flyway, I mean, right in the middle of it. So I'm wondering if the kinds of arguments that were made against that kind of green energy development are similar to the arguments that are being made now, and how that is, in a way, a precedent for really evaluating very closely so-called green energy development and how much of it really is green and how much of it is really harmful.
Based on what I've read and what I've heard from the Klickitat County commissioners, if this project is to be constructed, there'd be more wind and solar energy in this area. Right now, there are two proposed large proposed solar plants in Klickitat County. There's one that's already constructed or under construction. And these projects, you know, they're more than 5,000 acres projects, you know, and they're proposing millions of solar panels to cover lots of area. When I'm talking about acreages, and, you know, I'm talking like 12,000 acres right now. And then with the solar panels, there's more wind also, wind projects proposed down the road. And, you know, all this area, it's covering our usual and accustomed lands that we gather our foods. And I've been bringing it up that the local tribes are not being consulted prior to these leases, these solar leases. You know, some of it is private land and some of it is DNR. State land, Washington State DNR land. And based on our treaty negotiations in 1855, we retain our rights to fish, hunt, and gather on those state lands, on state and federal lands. And when they're doing these leases with Hillary Fons and her staff, with the DNR, they're infringing on our gathering rights. And these are 40-year leases, solar leases, and that's going to exclude us to that land for 40 years. And some of these lands are hunting lands for Yakima Nation hunters. And they're also root digging lands where I go, where my family's been going. And we're excluded from some of the existing wind farm already. There's one landowner, he lets us on his land and that's it. The rest of the landowners and the wind farm companies, they lock us out. And so that's what's going to happen with these solar, and especially the DNR lands where we're supposed to have access. And all these solar projects have DNR properties, and they're 500 acres approximately for each project. So, you know, that's 1,500 acres that we're going to be excluded. And when you're going to plaster solar panels on it, you're going to totally ruin the land and the habitat that grows there. And so, you know, that's a big impact. And I can't say these projects are green because the solar panels are not 100% recyclable. And so are the lithium batteries. And right now, they don't even know what's going to happen to the lithium batteries after, you know, you got to renew them. There's not a recycling program for them. And another issue is lithium's coming from out of, you know, lithium where the batteries are coming from out of the country. And we have Paiute tribes in McDermott, Nevada, fighting lithium mining right now on their land near their reservation. And they're worried about their groundwater getting contaminated. That's going straight to the reservation. That's going to directly impact their health. So, you know, these projects are not green as they say they're green. And so are the windmills. They're, you know, they kill birds and bats and other, you know, they impact the wildlife. So I can't say that these projects are green. Personally, I see them as having more negative impacts to the environment and to the cultural resources. And when I read Governor Inslee's climate plan, he says in his on his website, these are going to be environmentally justice projects. But I don't see that. It's not 100% environmental friendly when you're covering 5,000 acres, 9 square miles of solar that is good, you know, that has good wildlife habitat. And this project's going to enclose a fish hatchery. And, you know, you kind of wonder what's the future of that fish hatchery that supplies fish to the whole community in this area. So I really can't say in that all this proposed energy is 100% green.
Yeah, so just to go off a little bit of what Elaine said, I agree. I think it's really questionable whether you can consider this pump storage development as a green energy. Aside from the tremendous environmental justice concerns, which Elaine's been describing, the development itself is expected to require, you know, 9,000 acre feet of Columbia River water for its initial fill and an additional 390 acre feet per year to offset evaporation and leakage losses. And what this really means is millions of gallons of Columbia River water that will be used on this project. And so there's also the possibility of refill if any of these reservoirs simultaneously need to be emptied for repair. I know there's a plan that if one reservoir needs repair, they'll empty that water into the second. But what if both need repair? And so when the developer calls this project a closed loop pump storage project, it's really a misleading description when you consider the company's plans to use so much Columbia River water to sustain the reservoirs. And when you're thinking of how overdrawn the Columbia River is already with the hydropower dams, you know, increasing temperatures, what's a proliferation of pump storage projects feeding off of the Columbia going to do as well?
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Elaine Harvey, a member of the Rock Creek Band who works with the Yakima Nation Fisheries, and Simone Anter with Columbia Riverkeeper. And we're talking about why a proposed pump storage hydroelectric development threatens irreplaceable tribal cultural resources, fish, and wildlife. I want to continue on that thread that Elaine was talking about the ungreen nature of solar arrays and wind farms, because I think we run into this conundrum where we're talking about the need to build up our green energy infrastructure, and we mostly think about wind farms and solar arrays at this point. So, Elaine, do you have a sense of how to reconcile a way to develop solar and wind energy in a way that would actually be truly green and also wouldn't violate your cultural history, your sites, and your ceded land?
I think that the developers, the county, the state, the state officials who are involved in siting these projects should consult with the tribes, affected tribes, all the affected tribes prior to siting these projects. And there are locations in the state that I think, you know, would be good locations to put solar arrays and possibly wind. And that's one issue I believe that would be key and important, is having, you know, the developers, state officials, and county officials consult with the tribe and bring them in early in the process instead of after the fact. And I think it would save a lot of heartache and legal battles, you know, if that was done in a proper way, and so that the tribe can put input in and say, you know, this is an important area, or this is a sacred mountain, or this is an important area for salmon and salmon passage and migration. It's not wise to take water near the John Day Dam because there's so much salmon passage there. You have adult salmon and steelhead and other species going up the river, and you have juvenile going down. You know, it's not a key and a good place for, you know, taking water out from the Columbia. Whereas you have other places in the Columbia that wouldn't be so harmful to the fish. So I think consultation with the tribes in the early stages would benefit everybody in the long run.
Well, I hear consultation with the tribes is being called out for in all these fossil fuel projects that are being protested up and down the Northwest, in particular Jordan Cove, which is not being that the Klamath tribes there feel like they've been really left out of the discussion of the pipeline that would go through. And in Tacoma, the Puyallup tribe has been fighting the LNG facility that's now actually almost totally built originally without a permit. So do you see that there's any movement in the tribes actually getting the consultation that you're demanding? Is anybody listening?
Recently, Joe Biden did make a statement, and he reaffirmed proper and early consultation with the tribes. And I thought that was important. It's it was recently after he, you know, became elected. But that has to go from his level down to, you know, the state levels. But with our new Secretary of Interior, Deb Haaland, I think, you know, that is, you know, it's within reach. And I think we have some good governors, Governor Inslee and, you know, and Brown, that also can reinforce that statement that the tribes need to be consulted, you know, prior to, and, you know, these projects to be established and, you know, permitting to go into place.
Well, Simone, I want to talk more about this company, Rye Development, that's behind this pump storage project. And particularly, you mentioned that they were really muddying the waters in terms of pretending that there's a lot of support for the project there isn't. It also seems that there's an awful lot of greenwashing. And I wonder how you see that.
Yeah. So I think in particular with this developer, so they're also the ones behind the Swan Lake pump storage development that is being opposed by the Klamath tribe in Oregon. And there's been a lot of issues brought up there with consultation and siting, and the same issues that you're seeing here at the Goldendale project. So it seems to be kind of a trend of this particular developer for this site. So that's the same developer, which I think is really important to note and draw the parallels in the opposition that's going down with the Swan Lake project, because that project's a bit further along in their licensing process than this one is. But you're seeing kind of the same trends from the developer. So it's definitely, it seems to be a strategy of the developer. aside from protests from Yakima Nation, which Elaine has, you know, really greatly described, we've also seen letters from the Confederated Tribes and Bands of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. They have yet to conduct any of their cultural and archaeological surveys of the area, even though there's been early participation in the FERC process. There's also in the FERC docket letters from the Nez Perce saying that they didn't know about the development and therefore they didn't have the opportunity to submit, you know, study requests and determine detrimental impacts to their tribe. So despite the developers saying that there is consultation, we're seeing, you know, tribes saying no, there's not, multiple tribes. In terms of greenwashing too, there's other impacts that this project's going to have that I think make it not so much a green energy project. We've talked a little bit about the reservoirs, but I think we've yet to say the size of them. So one of them will be 60 acres across and the other 63 acres. So we're talking about huge reservoirs being excavated into the hillsides here. And if you look at kind of a picture of this area, there's, you know, a wind farm right there and tons of wind turbines, which already have, you know, a significant bird mortality issues. So when you're introducing two large-scale water bodies to this area, you're going to see an influx and increase of birds here, which are going to result in even more bird mortalities when combining the two, the you know, pump storage with the wind turbines. Also, there has been really interesting comment letters in the FERC docket from Turlock Irrigation District, who I believe buys the wind from those wind turbine farms, with these wind analyses saying that once you introduce these sorts of reservoirs here, these water bodies here, they're actually going to kind of change the wind patterns. And I'm no expert on this, so definitely read these comment letters, but it's so fascinating. Change kind of the wind patterns here that'll actually draw wind away from the wind turbines, therefore decreasing wind energy here. So you're kind of seeing the battle of the quote unquote green energy here, which is, you know, kind of an interesting thing. I mentioned bird mortality rates. There's documented prairie falcon and golden eagle nests in the area. And then other concerns that we've raised, you know, in our scoping comments and our 401 comments, are there's real issues with these reservoir water quality and impacts that will happen from those and with leakage into the ground and all of this. So there's a lot of unknowns with this project, and we've seen FERC and Ecology send, you know, multiple letters to the developer voicing a lot of our concerns and asking for additional studies and additional information that they need before they can act on any of these applications. And so I think that's also really great to see. It's not just us drawing, you know, saying, hey, there's real holes in this proposal and there's these real problems. There's also the licensing agencies also drawing light to that. So there's been, like I said, I think FERC has issued 3 requests for additional information, and Ecology has issued 1 that they need coming up really soon before they're able to, you know, make their 401 decision. So I think it's still up in the air how the developer is going to respond or what studies will be responded. But there are a lot of questions here in terms of how this project's going to impact the surrounding environment.
Well, I understand that the lower reservoir is on the site of an old aluminum smelter. Is that correct?
I believe the footprint, and Elaine, correct me if I'm wrong, I think that the footprint at one point overlapped part of that aluminum smelter, but I don't believe it actually completely overlaps anymore, but is very close and is something that Ecology is still looking at and is, in fact, one of the reasons why the last pump storage project development that was proposed here was denied a license by FERC, was because of concerns with this aluminum smelter site cleanup area.
What are some of the concerns?
Just, you know, how developing here and how excavating and having, you know, foot traffic here is going to impact that cleanup. What is going to be dug up, how the dirt, what's going to be in it, how it's going to be disposed of, and all of that. Is there a plan for that? And so those were some of the concerns I can think of off the top of my head, but I would have to go back to review kind of FERC's determination on that. And another, I have one more example of muddling of public opinion here. In its initial application to FERC, Rye included a section of letters of support, one of which was a letter sent by the Department of Ecology, which, after reading the letter, was clearly not a letter of support for this project. You know, we sent a letter to Ecology saying, hey, did you know this was included in Rye's application? Could you issue a letter saying that that's misconstruing your letter? And they did, because it was definitely not a letter of support. So we were really happy to see Ecology, you know, issue a new letter saying that they were not issuing letters of support. I don't want to say they were not in support, because that's not what they said.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFGL, PFM, and KODXL, PFM, KMUN, and KCPB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. We're talking today with Simone Anton with Columbia Riverkeeper, and also Elaine Harvey, who's a member of the Rock Creek Band and works for the Yakima Nation Fisheries. We're talking about why a proposed pump storage hydroelectric development threatens irreplaceable tribal cultural resources, fish, and wildlife. Simone, every time I've had Columbia Riverkeeper on the show for the last umpteen years, we've been talking about your opposition to fossil fuel projects. So how does it feel to be opposing something that's being proposed as a green energy project?
As I'm sure you and your listeners know, Riverkeeper has spent over a decade, you know, closely working with tribal nations and Columbia River communities up and down the river to stop the huge onslaught of fossil fuel development in the Pacific Northwest. The result of this was stopping, you know, the proliferation of fracked gas to methanol refineries, new pipelines, fracked gas-fired power plants, coal export terminals, and oil by rail terminals. And all of this really protected the environment and public health. And now there's a great opportunity to really draw the line in the sand about what kind of energy development we want in the Pacific Northwest, and to truly stand in solidarity with tribal nations. And like I said, we're not generally opposed to pump storage or true green energy development, but you know, this project we are opposed to. We stand in solidarity with tribal nations opposing this project and with Yakima Nation. And I think that the Pacific Northwest really needs to take a hard look at how they're going to pursue green energy, or quote unquote green energy development, because I think Elaine and I have made a great argument as to why you could consider this project to not be green energy.
Well, Elaine, what do you see for the future? How do you see your struggle against this particular project moving forward? And how does that fit into all the past struggles you've had where the tribes have not been all that successful in being listened to and consulted with?
Yeah, I have a grave concern for this water pump storage project, because if it does go through and gets approved and constructed, it's going to encourage more wind and solar projects in the area. And as I mentioned before, these projects are already in our fish and hunting grounds and also root gathering grounds. And, you know, and that's just three projects. And you're thinking down the road in the future, and you're thinking, well, you know, we tried our best to oppose and the water pump storage and some of these other projects. And, you know, it's really hard for me to think about this, because before I went to college, you know, my grandmother, she told me, I'm going to go to college for this. And when you come back, you know, there's a reason why you're going to come back, and not knowing in the future, you know, the reason I went to college. And I'll just say this statement now. She said, you know, a long time ago, our people had to fight with bows and arrows. And she goes, now today in this world that we live in, you know, you got to have an education, and you got to go to college, get that education, and come back. And so after I, you know, left college, she passed away just immediately after, but she asked me to come home, and she asked me to take care of these lands where I'm from, in Klickitat County primarily, because that's where our foods are, where our band is from. The Rock Creek Band is, you know, that's kind of our area where we gather foods, and it's been that way since time immemorial. And so I really take it to heart what I do and what I try to give awareness to everybody that, you know, we're still here. We still exist. We still live in Klickitat County. We still go to our longhouse at Rock Creek. We have our ceremonies. And these foods are sacred to us, and they're supposed to be there for us. And so protecting our lands, our waters, our wildlife and fish, you know, it's really important to me, to our Rock Creek band, to our tribal leaders, Yakima Nation. You know, it's for our future. It's for the future generations. If we don't have clean water, if we don't have these lands for the wildlife and, you know, and the fish, in the rivers, then, you know, what's in the future for our future generations? And that's kind of where I stand today. You know, I just think about the future, our future generations, and hope for the best. And you know, it's really disheartening to even think about the future with what's happening now with these so-called green energy projects, I say, because they're not green and they're impacting us directly. We're losing our lands that we can gather food on. We're losing winter deer habitat that's really important in the county. When it snows up in the Simcoes, the deer, you know, they come down, and that's where they're building, you know, these solar projects. And not only these projects impact the wildlife and the birds, they're impacting the fish. Because to construct these projects, they need water. And, you know, the fish are getting affected as well.
What kind of projects would you see, what would you like to see built that would be considered alternative, sustainable green energy projects as opposed to the ones that are being built right now?
Well, I think the what's everybody is calling green is solar and wind. But I think, like I mentioned before, appropriate siting of these projects. Because I'm not totally against the projects, the solar and wind, but I think they could be appropriately sited in areas in the state or states that's not going to impact so much of the environment for wildlife, for fish, for, you know, we want to keep a good environment for the future. We don't want to just put millions of solar panels that's going to exclude wildlife. And that's what's happening now in Roosevelt at the Lund Hill Solar Project. They're just going to build these 8-foot fences and wildlife were excluded. And good luck if they get in there, you know. One issue in the Klickitat County is there's an energy overlay zone. And the energy overlay zone is supposed to encompass 2/3 of Klickitat County. So back in the early 2000s, they created this energy overlay zone. And it's only mainly talking about wind projects. And now you're bringing in solar. And one issue with the county is they're passing these solar projects through under wind farm ordinances. And really, our county does not have solar ordinances or a water pump storage ordinance. And I've been bringing this up to the county commissioners recently because they're kind of pushing these through. And if you read their EIS documents, it's kind of funny because they don't even take wind farm off of it. And so it's not fair that these are going through. And Yakima Nation, WFW, and, you know, everybody's submitting their comments for the concerns of wildlife for cultural resources. And, so that's one big issue in Klickitat County.
Well, I've actually wondered why they don't place solar arrays on the rooftops of Walmarts and other big box stores. And I'm thinking about all these large flat roof buildings in Hood River and the Dalles. I'm not sure it's going to be quite equivalent to the acreage that they want to put the solar arrays on in Klickitat County. But is that one of the thoughts that you've had about maybe trying to site more of this green energy on already built infrastructure?
That's what I think would be better also, is building on lands that are already disturbed, that aren't natural, that aren't good farmlands, that, you know, you're not going to find a large diversity of wildlife and fish and birds. There's areas that, you know, where solar panels could be placed in, like you mentioned, on top of Walmarts or individual homes and also these projects that are proposed are so large. Like I mentioned, one project's 5 or 6,000 acres, you know, and that's going to cover 9 square miles. of land. You know, that's, you know, large. It's a large project, and there's a lot of wildlife that are going to be affected there. And I was listening to the legislation these past few months, and one of the state biologists who comments on all these projects was making a statement that just for 2021, there's 26 solar proposed projects in the state of Washington that he's dealing with. And if you think about the area of those 26 projects, it's 50 square miles of Washington state that they're proposing to convert to solar. And that's a big area. And in Washington state also, you know what I mean? And in Klickitat County, there's 15,000 right there of that, you know, acreages of those 26 projects. So, you know, not just 2021, you're thinking about 2022 and, you know, down the road. And it's like, whoa, you know, how much more energy is going to be required? And then I was reading the FERC license for the water pump storage. And if you look at their maps, they have a red line going straight across to Oregon, and it's going straight to California. And then all these energy projects keep saying, well, we're following the governor's, he wants 100% green by 2030, 2050. But what about California? And why are we sending all our power down? You know, if you think about this water pump storage, you look at their maps and they got a red line going straight to Oregon down to California. And it's like, why do we have to like live with this water pump storage and all these energy projects? And it's going to California.
Good question. Well, Simone, in the last moments we have, what can listeners do to stop this project and to redirect the goals of the states and of industry that's trying to or proposing that they are building green energy to actually build green energy facilities that respect and consult with the tribes?
Yeah, if listeners would like to take action, we have a petition on Columbia River Keeper's website, which is www.columbiariverkeeper.org, asking Governor Inslee and Senators Murray and Cantwell to stand in solidarity with tribal nations who oppose this hydroelectric development. You can also learn more at our website by going to our work tab, Saving Salmon and then New Hydro, where we have, you know, a Q&A about this project. We link to letters from the Yakima Nation, from other tribal nations, opposition, other environmental nonprofits, and where we post updates on where this project stands in both the state licensing project and the federal licensing project.
Simone and Elaine, it's really great talking to you today, and good luck with all your work. Thanks for being on Locus Focus.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks, Barbara.
We've been talking with Elaine Harvey with the Rock Creek Band and Simone Anter with Columbia Riverkeeper. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. Go to kboo.fm and click on the donate button on the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. Next week, we talk with John Dunn, author of The Glitter in the Green, about the allure of hummingbirds and the threats they face. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We'll go out with music by Eulalie. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, get your COVID shots, and remember to socially distance and wear a mask. Machita moy, kan spewa yebi. Machita moy, ang.
там той конспект.